Thank you, Phil, for the introduction, and thank all of you for coming. I know that the school year ended for a lot of you recently, and on a day like today, after all the rain we've had last week, I'm very glad you've joined us, even though we're indoors. We couldn't really move this outside. We also, I think, have a number of people who are joining us via web as well, and so they feel free, for those of you who are joining us on the web, to direct questions to Amr, who will be relaying them to us in this discussion. I'm going to try to keep this like a discussion. And there's a short presentation, but I do encourage any of you who haven't looked at it to look at the report itself. And I'm going to kind of just run through some of it quickly. But what I'd really like to do with all of the folks who are here with all these different perspectives is to have a conversation about a lot of the topics that we've brought up. We've got a lot more of those if we run out. I think Phil kind of went through a couple of things that I've done, but I also want to emphasize a couple of things that I haven't done. I am not a law professor. I don't teach law in a legal institution. I've also honestly never practiced, so I'm not a practicing attorney. What I have been doing in the last few years is been doing a lot of training and professional development, and so a lot of the perspective that went into this came from doing that kind of work, where a lot of the folks that we were looking at was skills training for particularly recent grads, but actually a lot of attorneys across the spectrum of professional development. And this interest, it's been a real, it's been really exciting to be able to pursue some of the research here, and it's been a real privilege. So I wanted to thank the Berkman Center for letting me have this opportunity. As you can hear from all the questions that people were raising just now, you know, the topic of technology, education, legal practice is kind of a catch-all, you know, because technology touches so much of what we do, that to say technology is basically to say almost everything nowadays. So it is sometimes hard to focus on one or two different things, but we'll try to focus on a couple of things. Let's see if this works. All right, we have to use this keyboard.
Cool.
So, one thing I found when I was doing this research is that everything suddenly becomes relevant, and then also suddenly everyone else is doing the same research you are. So this, there was an op-ed that was published in the Globe just a couple months after this paper was published that basically said in about three paragraphs what I was saying in 20 pages and much better and much more succinctly about what's going on in medical practice and in the medical school. And here we have a quote from the article about how teamwork is increasingly important for doctors and how teamwork nowadays means technology. And that's one of the things that I found in the process of doing this research. Another thing that came out that was highly relevant was this comic strip, where, I don't know if you can read it in the back, but there's a senior attorney standing there saying to one of the junior attorneys who's looking very unhappy, "I'm sorry if you don't like Ms. Butler, but that's the rule. All new lawyers wear it for the first 3 months. It's a little paper hat that says trainee." But if those of you who watch Grey's Anatomy or any of those other shows know that doctors go through more than 3 months of wearing the paper hat. They go through years and years of that. Lawyers really don't, at least not in any kind of official way. So I think it's a very interesting contrast. So let me just quickly describe what the research, what the focus was and the motivation for it. It was basically, how has technology changed everything? How has technology changed what lawyers are doing? And how does, therefore, technology change what new lawyers or aspiring lawyers need to know? And on along the way, how can technology be part of a solution for any challenges that might be arising? So basically what we did was a combination of things. We had we had one focus group that John Palfrey helped to moderate in New York with a group of very senior attorneys and managing partners in New York law firms. I interviewed a whole slew of people who ranged from practicing attorneys to legal technologists to law professors to people in the continuing legal education or CLE world. And we also did a survey with our partners LexisNexis of 142 people who were in the general group of folks who were looking at people with less than 7 years of experience, and we generated some pretty good data from that. We also, of course, there's a lot of data out there as well, and kind of dug a lot of that up for this research. I do want to emphasize that a lot of this research was intended to be a survey, and a lot of what we found is kind of indicative, but is not scientific in a lot of different ways. But from the feedback I've been getting, it seems like it resonates with a lot of people. I might characterize it in a certain way, and other people might characterize it in another way, but I'd be interested to hear how you see the conclusions and findings. There's a couple of, in addition to the questions we posed, there's a couple of background trends that are going on, and some of them are technological, some of them aren't. The first one isn't, or at least not directly. There's a trend where there's an increasing bifurcation, or at least bifurcation, maybe tri or four, but there's kind of more and more diversity amongst legal practice now than there was 10, 20 years ago. And in particular, one of the trends is towards the rise of the mega firms with over 500 attorneys. And these firms didn't exist 10, 15 years ago. There wasn't even a category for them when you were doing your survey of who all the law firms were in the world. So that's a major, major change, and probably technology has something to do with enabling that to happen. There's also been some discussion about whether different schools or different programs within schools are putting students on different tracks. And there was one fairly provocative article in a journal recently that posited that a Harvard Law School graduate would have more in common with a Harvard Business School graduate than with someone from Suffolk Law School. And I don't know how true that is in terms of the data that's out there, but I think one thing that is important to note is whether there is or isn't a track, there definitely are very different practices. That the person practicing as a junior associate in a 1,000-person law firm that's spread all over the world is in a very different practice and a very different technological setting than somebody who's a solo anywhere in this country. So I think that's clear. Whether that correlates with legal education is another question. Another background trend, and so these other two trends are technologically related, is just the huge amounts of data that's out there. Whether that data has to do with your practice, your clients, kind of the factual information involved, there's just so much information. All of us know that. All of us, realize how much email we get every day. And then there's also what you might call the rising floor of minimal technology. What kind of technology do you need to survive in today's world? It used to be that you could just get by with paper and pen, and increasingly that's just not the case. So I broke down from the research, I broke down the skills that I saw into three major categories and then a fourth of that's kind of basic. But in terms of, I'll describe these a little bit later, I call them data dieting. It's a little bit changed from the language in the report, but data dieting, techno-social skills, meta-lawyering, and then basic technology management. And I think this last one particularly became highlighted when I started looking at the differences between kind of the mega practices and the solo practices. And I'll get to that in a bit. So this first one, data dieting, I'm using the word dieting very specifically here, not about kind of trying to slim down, but it's basically a smart, strategic, conscious choice of what kind of information you're looking for. There is a concept of data or information obesity out there that you just kind of keep ingesting this information till far beyond what you need to do your work. But I think part of it is also finding the right, you can get a lot of information but get the wrong kind. So there seems to be a big challenge right now of finding high quality data in an efficient manner. And then, so for one example is in e-discovery, where even just only 4 or 5 years ago, your average e-discovery case kind of involved 5 gigabytes of data, and now we're up to well over 500 gigabytes of data, which is just, it's obviously an order of magnitude different in terms of how much information you're going through when you're doing, e-discovery is electronic discovery when you're trying to basically uncover facts about the case, and a lot of these facts are now captured in emails, as all of you probably know from the situation with the attorney generals losing their emails. And you know, it's going to be a $3.1 billion industry. This is a very large segment of what's going on out there. But also, when I'm talking about data, I'm also talking about this this kind of a business concept of going from data to information to knowledge to wisdom. That data is just that; it's just a bunch of numbers or words or letters. But that, as you kind of figure out what to do with that data, it becomes information, and then you can do something with it. And then figure out what's your strategy, what's your plan, what does that information lead you to? And one concept that's although it's been kind of disfavored recently, is the concept of knowledge management. That in addition to just having lots of data, that what you want, since we're lawyering is a knowledge-based industry, is to try to treat your knowledge as assets within your organization that you're going to manage as you would with widgets or inventory or whatever. But there's been some, from kind of the cutting edges of people who are doing knowledge management, there's been some rumbling and discussion about whether we've kind of crossed a threshold with knowledge management because of Google, that there's so much information and knowledge out there that what you have internal to your own firm is in some cases incomparable to what's out there on the web, and why bother keeping all this stuff internally when everything out there is better than your stuff? Of course, you could take that to some logical limit where then there's no information out there because nobody's keeping it anymore. But in this quote here, which I know got a lot of attention from people who are looking at this research, is this quote that said, and even in big firms, attorneys would rather go to EDGAR, which is where the federal government posts these SEC filings, and see what's scanned and did as an attachment to a filing, rather than see what is in their own, what their own attorneys do, and this isn't from a SCADM attorney. In other words, why if you can kind of crib off of the best, why bother with your own knowledge? So there's this change that's happening in terms of how much knowledge and information is available out there in the big wide world versus what you're kind of keeping inside your own garden, and what is the comparable value of those two? What I also hear a lot of is, sure, we have a knowledge management system, but I can't find anything in it. And this is actually the case with the system that I was working on for the legal services program. We had 9,000 documents, which by these standards is nothing. In terms of, it's not anywhere close to 400 gigabytes of information. Even so, it just became exponentially harder every year to make it so that people can find what they were looking for. So this is becoming a real challenge now. It's not just, is no longer getting the data, but what are you going to do with it now that you have it? How do you turn that into information and knowledge that you can act on? Another major concept is techno-social skills. Basically, that the idea that we are increasingly structuring our social relationships through technology, whether it's email via BlackBerry 3 a.m. or whatever the case might be, that our relationships are increasingly mediated through technology. And in particular, I was interested in teamwork and how teamwork is changing. We're seeing, at least in the bigger firms, but also even at the solo level, larger teams, more teams, more complex teams. In other words, teams that are spread geographically across cultural and national boundaries. And especially in the case of these larger teams or international teams, technology mediating those teams. And what we're finding is that people really prefer using email and kind of some old school technologies like conference calls and, of course, face-to-face meetings, and to a lesser extent, software that's specific to that area of practice. What people didn't seem to like very much, even though they did a lot of it in the bigger firms, is video conferencing. There's just something about that technology that while people are using it, they don't really find it all that helpful, at least according to the surveys. Likewise, instant messaging maybe just hasn't even been implemented. Here are some charts. There's more in the report itself about kind of what's going on in terms of the numbers of teams that are out there, that people are active on. No teams is this segment right here, but at least one team from here on in, and there's a good segment of people here who are on six or more active teams. these are teams that are active at the moment that they were answering the survey, not like over the course of the year. Likewise, percentage of the teams that are outside the office, this segment here is that, you know, this entire, the entire team is inside the office, but you can see 1.3% right over here is this wedge over here is over half of the team is not in your local office. It could be that you're the one person on that team who is in some other office, but that's now a reality for a lot of folks. And it's actually kind of interesting when I put out there the idea of teamwork. This is now less about technology than about just kind of the culture of law schools or lawyering. And I got a lot of feedback that this has nothing to do with technology. This is just lawyers who don't like working together. And I posted to a blog that I post on called Law School Innovations, where a lot of people post about changes in law school education and about teamwork and maybe some things that we can do to encourage teamwork. And these are two. I normally get zero comments on these things, but this one I got like seven. And these are two of the comments. Some of them, I'm obviously picking out the negative ones here, but basically there is this attitude that, you know, I'm in law school. I'm personally successful. I don't want to drag myself down with this team that's of people who are inferior to me. And, you know, it's a very interesting attitude. It may or may not be true that, you know, that maybe these people will drag you down. I think that there are a lot of team projects that we put together in educational settings that are not great in terms of how things work out. But then again, maybe that's also true of how we work in general, is that there's a lot of teams we have that aren't great. And if you're not going to figure it out, you're going to hit that sooner or later. Why not during law school when the stakes are honestly a lot lower? But this is just some feedback I was getting on the concept of teamwork. Then there's another concept that is a little bit more inchoate, is a little bit more speculative, and I call it meta-lawyering. And it's basically developing systems of practice, as opposed to direct practice. You're developing a whole system. It might be, in the case of e-discovery, there's a Morrison Forrester, or MoFo, has just gotten to the news because they're experimenting with a new exciting way to do electronic discovery, which is that you scan things and you hit Control F and you search for them, which when you think about it, it was patently obvious that that's what you should have done from the beginning, but there was all sorts of financial incentives not to, as well as just kind of general resistance to trying to use technology in any new way. But to actually do that, and a very legitimate reason why you wouldn't want to do that is that you have to actually really understand discovery to be able to automate it. You have to really understand these are the terms we're looking for, and to do enough of it to say, you know what, this term keeps popping up over and over again, and so I'm going to automate this by putting this search query together. So it's not just a simple matter of, well, we can just do a search and find. You have to actually understand something about the patterns that emerge over time, and that does come from wisdom of practice over time. So that's what I would consider meta-lawyering. You have to actually step back from what you're doing at the moment. You're looking for all documents that have to pertain to this particular firing, to saying, well, what's the pattern that I have to look for that's going to emerge this time and maybe next time as well? Similarly with document automation, when a lot, especially a lot of smaller practices who do kind of what you might call bread and butter work, put together these documents that you kind of automate, and you just kind of plug in all the forms and the fields. To be able to create one of those in the first place implies that you have to know at another level of abstraction what your practice is all about. Rather than generating the document on the spot for this one particular client, you're actually thinking two steps ahead. How am I going to generate this document for 100 clients, and what are they going to have in common? Similarly, with case management and evaluation, I was working on case management system for the Massachusetts Legal Aid programs, and one of the big projects there was to figure out, well, how are we going to evaluate, or how are we going to let people collect data about the outcomes from these things? To be able to do that, we found you had to really, again, understand not just individual cases, but then all cases. Across many individuals and clients. And why technology has something to do with this is that technology forces you to formalize what would normally be tacit or knowledge or wisdom. Technology works on code. And so to be able to encode your understanding of a search, of a document generation, of evaluation or case management, you have to be able to articulate in a very precise way what you're trying to do, rather than simply just kind of going on as you always do and just implicitly in the back of your head saying, oh yeah, well this is a good case, this is a bad case, and just kind of keeping track that way. Technology does force you to be much more explicit about what you're doing. And then finally, basic technology. This is very interesting because when we started this research and John had the focus group in New York, and again, this is a focus group with like the big law firms, everybody said, you know what? We do not need to teach our lawyers technology. And that's probably true. You know, they don't need to teach them how to use a mouse or a computer or a keyboard or any of those kinds of things. But there's a certain assumption built into that, which is that you're in this very large organization with huge amounts of infrastructure supporting what you're doing. And that's one of the advantages of being in a large firm, and why you create large firms, is that you can have that infrastructure. You have tech support. You have people who are managing your servers and all of that. The issue is that if you're not in that world, which is the vast majority of all attorneys, I believe it still is the case that the majority of attorneys are, or if not the majority, then very close to it, are still are solo practitioners. So we always talk about the big firms, when in fact most lawyers are solos or in firms of 2 to 10, you know, partners. These small practices have significantly less access to just basic technology support. 10% of all solos, this is from an ABA survey, report no tech support whatsoever. And then there's a substantial number that report very minimal tech support. A lot of them lack accounting software, billing software, I mean, just basic business processes that you would need as a small business to stay alive. And across the board, on every single type of training you can imagine, they have less access to it. Whether it's in-person, you know, face-to-face training, video training, anything, consistently across the board, always have less training than their bigger counterparts. And what does that mean? I mean, part of this is what I was saying in the beginning, is that we're looking at very different law practices. And so there's not necessarily an answer. If you are going into small practice, you probably need to know a lot more about, if not managing this technology yourself, which I don't think is a great idea to just sit there managing your own servers, then how do you pick a vendor to do that? How do you manage that technology? How do you oversee it? That's something that a person going off into a big firm will never have to think about. And so, you know, if we're training attorneys on the assumption that they're going off to these big firms, then there's a whole chunk of skills that they're not learning. But I know that there's also a lot of resistance to the idea of teaching technology, that it's kind of, you know, not really what law school is all about. So that's an interesting challenge I think we face. So moving over to the other half of the research, which is the learning, and this is where I'm just going to kind of pose questions more than raise any kind of answers, is basically three questions. Who should teach these skills? What skills should we be teaching? And how should we be teaching those skills? So starting with the who, is anyone teaching practice skills? And let's just back off technology for a moment, just talk about all skills. The answer so far seems to be not really. You know, back in the, I believe it was the early 90s when the McCrae report came out, there was a lot of attention in that report to, well, law schools should be teaching skills, but not just law schools, but, you know, everyone should be focusing on that. And then the Carnegie report that just came out a few months ago similarly reports very little skills teaching in law schools. Now, that would be fine if, like medical schools, you had like a process afterward where medical, I spoke with some medical educators who said, well, there's a very explicit bargain where we prepare you for the next preparation. And that used to be the case in legal education, where you knew people were going off to an apprenticeship. However good or bad those apprenticeships were, at least there that was what was going on. But increasingly, there was a study done by Pace Law School a few months, actually about a year ago, that found that small and mid-sized firms do not want to hire people out of law school, straight out of law school, because they want people with skills. So, you know, if the law schools aren't providing them, who is? Maybe the big firms? I mean, some of the big firms have started significantly expanding their professional development arms as kind of a competitive advantage thing, so that they could recruit people, because increasingly graduates from law schools realize that they need to get these skills somewhere, and they're starting to ask for it as part of how they choose between these big firms. A lot of times you also find that people go off into public interest areas, maybe because they have this real interest in that kind of work, and also because that's one of the areas where you're going to get hands-on experience and learn right away in a way that you're not in other areas. But it's an open question, is who is providing these skills? And if no one's providing the skills, then who should? And also not just who should, but what kinds of careers should we be preparing people for? Again, there's a big difference, and going back to the topic of technology, there's a big difference between preparing people for a big firm practice and small firm practice or solo practice. Is this the law school's job to start sorting now, or how should that work? So that's a pretty big question. There's also the what we should be teaching. Do we know, for example, what best practice is? And the McCrae report does lay out a whole bunch of ideas of this is maybe some of the indicia of good interviewing, of good counseling, of good negotiations. It also recommended this creation of this American Institute for the Practice of Law, which to my knowledge did not actually happen. One question that I would raise is, especially with new technology now available, maybe you don't need one institute. Maybe what's possible is a whole network of law schools who together kind of concentrate in different areas and specialize and share and pool their knowledge, what they gather about practice of law. These are some kind of biased examples because I only know of a few here, but there, for example, the program negotiations here is a very practice-oriented program. It does research on the actual practice of negotiations rather than the theory. I mean, they also do theory, but there's a very practical element to it. Brigham Young, those of you who know Larry Farmer, knows that he's spent like the last few years doing very, very empirical research on the skill of interviewing and counseling. And right downstairs from here, one level below the Legal Aid Bureau is also the program on the legal profession here, which is kind of looking at the legal profession more on a kind of a business level. So there are these efforts underway. I'm sure there's a lot more that I'm not aware of that are kind of trying to look at legal practice rather than legal knowledge or legal information or theories or doctrine. So they're probably out there. And there certainly is, in the examples of medical schools and business schools, they're out there as not just studying doctrine or theories of what businessmen or doctors do, but also how they do it as a very explicit part of a lot of the research they do there. And I know a lot of folks in this room are clinical instructors, and I guess one question is how much of that do you see as being your jobs as well, is to help develop that wisdom about how to practice and then to help transmit that. So finally, there's a question a lot of you raised in the beginning, which is how should we be teaching? And so I think one thing that was very helpful as a framework that the Carnegie Report introduced was the idea of integrated rather than additive learning, which is to say you can always just tack on another course and keep adding more requirements. So you could say, you know what, we're going to need a basic technology training course. So here's a 2-credit course. We slap it on somewhere right before you graduate, when it's least painful. There you go, done. The much more difficult way to add these kinds of things into education is to integrate it into education. So for example, if you were to teach contracts, part of what could happen is to have people draft contracts using the real contract drafting software that's out there. Or practice in teams. So there's authentic, basically providing an authentic practice and learning environment where people are learning through doing, and they're learning both the practical skills and the substantive knowledge. It's not. I feel like there's been a lot of discussion and argument in law schools about is law schools about teaching you to think like a lawyer, or is it a trade? We don't want it to become a trade school. I don't actually see that being a choice as a necessary dichotomy. It's not that if you teach skills, then suddenly you're no longer teaching substantive law. In fact, I think both are more are better taught together, and I think probably a lot of you agree with that as clinical instructors. And so I'd like to think of clinics as practice labs, and labs in a very scientific sense, not just teaching, but also exploring, experimenting, learning about the practice, and then using that learning to publish findings and have as robust an intellectual conversation as the professors who are in classes and not in a clinical setting. There's also, I think a few people raised the question of technology to support activities outside of class. There's definitely the possibility that when you look at where teamwork happened in law school, maybe not in the classroom, but certainly a lot of us who are in law school remember being on study groups. And so is there something that we can do to support that? Is there something we can do to support the teamwork that students do in putting out a journal or in some of their organizations? And one thing particularly close to my heart is simulations. And a lot of simulations don't have to be technological. A lot of the simulations over at the negotiations program are on paper and you just back them out. But technology enables you to move simulations to another level by being able to gather more feedback and be more rigorous about how you run the simulation. We can talk about that if that's a topic that people find interesting. So let me just throw out some possibilities, and I was alluding to some already. So for example, can you imagine software like Facebook, or even Facebook itself, as groupware for study groups to kind of get together? And you know, how does a study group similar to what you do in a law firm? I mean, are you kind of generating this outline together, gathering information together? What kinds of technology would help support that? And can that technology be as similar or even identical to the kind of technology that you would use in a practice setting? Can that be a way for you to learn some of the techno-social skills that I was talking about? The second bullet is something that's happening at Stanford. You've got teams of law students and engineering students working together on, for example, drafting a patent application. And that's the teamwork part of this. But can they do this using, mediated through a very realistic computer or technological environment where a lot of the simulation, it could be a simulation where actually things happen to them. And as they kind of go through the process, you get word that another team has actually invented something very similar and is also applying for a patent. What would you do then suddenly to change your process? So that's another possibility. Another is clinical students, of course, using cutting edge case management software or other kinds of systems, but not just doing that, but also developing it. How much can students learn from helping to kind of set up a practice management system? Can students learn more about how to evaluate themselves and their own work if you have them working together on creating that evaluation system? I know that there's a couple law schools, New York Law School is one that comes to mind, that have students work on the technologies of legal practice, sometimes as an alternative career, but also, again, I think that when going to the concept of the meta-lawyering, that there's a possibility and potential here of being able to understand the practice of law much more deeply by being able to step back from it and saying, well, how should we set up a system rather than how should I just work with this one client? Now, I don't know if all students are ready for that kind of thing right away, of course. You probably certainly want them to have practice experience before they do that kind of thing, but it's certainly something to think about as a possibility. So I would just go back to the questions I posed before of who should teach these skills, what skills, and how should we teach these skills. I think this group's a little bit too large for us to just go around and have everybody say one thing. I would suggest these questions, but of course I'm absolutely open to talk about any other topics that people would find interesting. And I can answer also some of the questions that were raised in the beginning or have other people answer those questions.
I'm just curious, why is there a particular antipathy towards technology in a law school? It's like the 21st century. Wherever you're going to be, you're going to have to work with software. The reason why I ask is because I'm a serial entrepreneur, and one of my companies was in technical training, and most of my clients were one-on-one, SOHO, small office, home office, many of them being doctors and lawyers, and they really needed the help. And as you said, they didn't get the training in law school or whatever, but nevertheless, they needed to run a business, and they needed someone to be able to teach them how to do what needed to be done.
Sure.
So it's. I think it's a sort of like, at this point, it's sort of like an essential, now you don't have to be a computer scientist, but
right.
It would be an essential tool or something.
Well, I would throw that back out to the audience, actually, if anybody has any thoughts on that, either here or online, of is there, in fact, antipathy towards technology in legal practice or law schools, or is that just general technophobia in society at large? I don't know if anyone has thoughts on that.
I want to respond with a larger question. One thing that was striking to me about what you had to say is that you could apply many of these same questions to professional development in the ed school, and I think, you know, there are a lot of larger questions about what is effective professional development or professional instruction, and how is technology changing that, and also how can technology support that. And as I mentioned, one of the challenges I encounter in my work is that I'm working with educators or people in nonprofits who know their field, but they don't necessarily have knowledge of technology or of management skills or of the legal dimensions of their work either. So in one of the areas where you mentioned teamwork, I wondered about collaborations across the professional schools also in terms of practices of skills and just becoming aware of the dimensions of work in actual contexts. Mm-hmm. And again, how could technology potentially support that?
Mm-hmm. So one of the examples I gave was the work that's being done at Stanford in creating these cross-disciplinary teams, and they have fellows who create these simulations that are drawn from real world examples of how a real patent lawyer would work with a real engineer to write and file a patent. So there are examples. I mean, there's just all sorts of just nothing to do with any kind of cultural thing. But like, if your schedules or calendar years don't line up, you're already at a huge disadvantage. And so, you know, the fact that Stanford has a fairly unified calendar and a much stronger central university is nothing to do with technology, nothing to do with culture. That is just a logistical reality. You try to cross enroll here at the business school, you find that they have a very different calendar than the other schools, on purpose, I think. But there's all these other challenges that are not just cultural, but I think, you know, breaking down those silos is going to be very important.
And it seems like somehow that an internship process is a place where you might take account for those other dimensions of work besides the theoretical knowledge of the field.
Right. I think you might be able to tell from this that part of what I'm talking about here is just kind of using technology as an excuse to talk about education, because you find that technology maybe gets more attention or is, you know, easier to fund or whatever, but really the challenge here is more about the how do we teach, and the technology gives us perhaps some leverage and some place that we can kind of ask for change, but that the technology actually really represents something else, which is a better way to integrate the substantive knowledge with the practice knowledge.
Yeah, I'm just not sure how well I can articulate this, but I guess I'm concerned about, I mean, I'm a pro-clinical education person, obviously, but I do understand these underlying concerns about teaching sort of values and making sure basic theory and the raising of sort of fundamental legal issues happens inside legal education, and that there really is some integration. And I guess when I get concerned, and I even felt this concerned at the clinical education conference we just went to, that grounding of the way we educate students in real lives of real clients. I like simulation for as a supplement. I don't like it as the heart and soul of what clinical education, for example, should be like. And I wonder in all this about, and this isn't an anti-technology piece, this is sort of the larger question, about public interest and about the value of serving certain goals, making society better, social justice goals. And it felt at the clinical education conference, like less and less is spoken about. You know, it's about teaching practice, and law schools should change their focus to teaching practice. And I'm the last one to denigrate that, but I think it should be about teaching values. And so that's sort of one set of questions, and maybe related in some way is about these trends that you're seeing in solo practice and in large law firms. What trends do you see happening within legal services and community-based organizations and NGOs?
Well, I'm curious if anybody else could speak to the let's take them one by one, if anybody else has any thoughts about that first question. So I would frame it as, is there a tension between, in terms of like if there's an economy of attention that we have in law schools, how we should divvy it up between the knowledge and the skills and the values that we want to convey. And I'm curious if anybody else has any reactions to that thought.
I'm sure they're so separate. I mean, one of the things that happens in some of the clinics is that the students are sometimes nervous about interviewing a client, so they have to be kind of led through the process in order to get the facts out. And then they have to present something to the client, and a good clinical instructor will make sure that it's very carefully done. So they're seeing both some practical skills, but also the values of making sure that the work is high quality, that the client understands it. I don't know that you can separate certain kinds of skills values. I mean, they're kind of, don't they go hand in glove? And I'm not sure what, I think your point about, you're using technology to kind of open a series of questions is right, because I don't think that, certainly for legal research, it's important to know the technology, but for most other things, it isn't. You know, the most important thing I think I learned in law school from a practical point of view was make friends with the senior secretary. The senior secretary controls everything. She knows everything. She knows the schedule. She knows, you know, what's coming down. You get the hints from that. That has nothing to do with technology. That's basic personnel skills, and we don't teach any of that.
I guess I'm wondering not just about high quality service, but who you serve and
right.
how to promote those set of values.
Well,
and technology
yeah.
seems to me to be a wonderful. Has this wonderful democratizing, equalizing potential. I just get worried the extent to which we talk about it in this very neutral way, or we talk about clinical in this very neutral way about, you know, teaching skills, and we don't reroot this in values of social justice and dispersal of legal services to a larger community, you know?
Right. Well,
I'm not attacking you. I'm just sort
right.
of...
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, I would be the last to disagree with you on that point either. I would imagine there's some strategic, you know, decisions going on about how to place clinical within the law school settings, and, you know, in terms of the resources and prestige, honestly. But what I found most gratifying in the Carnegie report was the emphasis not just on skills, but it also called out the fact that law schools do not focus at all on values, don't really know how very much to talk about values. This is of very central importance to me in the work that I've been doing the last 4 years in developing training and professional development for legal aid attorneys, very similar work to what most of you here do. And one of the key elements of our mission was to make sure that for the new lawyers who are entering the legal services world, that they not only get the skills that they needed, how to interview a client, but how to do so in a manner that was consistent with our mission. So how do you interview a client with respect for the client, and so that you are engaged in client-centered practice? How do you, also when you're trying to do problem solving, do you just solve the specific legal problem in front of you? How do you also address, or at least think about the larger issues that are there, even if you don't have the resources to do anything about them at the moment, but at least to be aware of them, and maybe at some point in your practice start finding systemic solutions as well as individual solutions. Those are, and we did use technology to support that. We developed it's not sophisticated technology, we developed a video, it was like a 2-minute video that showed a client taking the bus from downtown, from kind of one of the poor neighborhoods of Boston to Greater Boston Legal Services, where along the way she kind of narrated what she was going through her head, which is that, you know what, this legal issue I'm facing is one of many, many issues. I don't trust my lawyer. As far as I'm concerned, my lawyer is just like my social worker, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, just kind of going through a lot of these feelings that the client would have. And, you know, by showing that to the new attorneys, it was really, for a lot of them, very eye-opening. It's not very sophisticated technology. We're talking about a video production here. So it's not... Yeah, I think it's not for me. It's not about the technology per se. I think for me, what's interesting is what does the technology enable you to do that maybe you couldn't do before, and to have that conversation before. Maybe you could have somebody read a story, but you know, a 2-minute video did that same thing. So I think there's a lot of ways in which technology, I think a simulation, for example, can put you in a difficult ethical situation where you don't even realize it, and then you make the decision, and after the fact that you can have a conversation, why did you make that decision? And have a conversation about doing that in a way that just reading about it or watching a film about it wouldn't convey, because you just made that decision in a way that you now have to kind of own and then look at and examine in a way that is not the case if it was somebody else making that decision and you're talking about it in the third person. So I think there's definitely a lot of overlap between the technology, between what technology enables us to do, but I would certainly not put the emphasis on the technology itself.
So there's a little discussion on the IRC.
Okay.
Whether there's a set of core skills, depending on which area. I am not a lawyer. I've never been. This is the closest I've ever been to law school. There's obviously a set of very specialized skills that would be very useful, but are there a set of core skills that could be taught to everyone as part of their legal education? Or are the skills always so specialized that it's really, you know, there isn't, it's not worth the time to teach the skills that you're not going to be using in your practice?
I anal as well. I'm not a lawyer either. So, I mean, but, and a lot of folks here, I'm sure, would have, I would personally defer to the McCrate report, which had like fairly detailed list of all of the skills that all attorneys should have, and being able to talk to a client is a basic skill that all attorneys should have. Whether that client has a mental disability or has a super huge ego because they're the CEO of a company, I mean, that's obviously substantively different,
or
right?
Both.
or both. Thank you. However, on the other hand, I don't know if the McCrate report really is all that great in practice, so I don't know if anybody has any response to that here in the audience. Yeah.
As someone who practiced in a mega firm for a couple of years, I could say that I think there are core skills that aren't taught by law schools that pretty much every lawyer needs to know. I have less confidence in saying that about solo practitioners, but I would think that a solo would need to know that stuff maybe even more than a big firm attorney, where you're working in a team and you can rely on other people to have different skills. So, I haven't read the McCrate report recently, but it seems to me that they had a good list, and I thought those were valid skills that they listed, including things like negotiating and talking to clients, research skills, writing, obviously, and learning to work as a team. And now I think with technology also some things like, being able to deal with a document management database of some kind, because how can you lawyer without that these days? So that kind of thing.
Do we teach interviewing and counseling here at Harvard?
Absolutely.
Yeah, in our clinical programs?
Yeah.
Okay. And so what are the other kinds of skills that we try to convey in the clinical?
Pretty much the whole list of McCrate report skills, negotiating, problem solving, fact investigation, oral advocacy. The McCrate report is still probably the best single list of skills out there, although it does need to be updated to include all the technological skills that lawyers need now that they didn't need in 1992, perhaps, when the report came out. It also includes a list of Debbie's gone. Of values, including the values that Debbie was talking about, including the duty of lawyers to act in the public interest and to help those who don't have resources. Still, maybe the best list of that. Also, the tension that Debbie's talking about exists everywhere in the clinical world between we try to synthesize theory and skill teaching and values together. That's what we clinicians have been doing, and some are moving further in one direction than in the other. It's an ongoing debate in the clinical world. But to the extent that your presentation, Gene, leads to my question, is sort of aspirational, is that, considering that that's what we think we're doing already, is that a critique in some way of the clinical enterprise? Is that contained in there, or of the clinical enterprise's position within the academy?
Well, I have a very specific recommendation about clinical programs, which is to try to use as much of the same technology that the corresponding organizations would have. And I know that that can be quite difficult, because even if the software itself is provided free, there's a huge amount of overhead in terms of setting up and then maintaining that software, which is kind of the hidden cost of doing that technology. So it was something fairly specific. But my other kind of bigger and I put this out again as a question, and I think we have four law schools here, is just what percentage of our students are going through the clinical programs?
Well, now it's somewhere close to 2/3
okay.
of students at Harvard are doing clinical programs.
And at the other schools, I don't know what the approximate.
No, but every first-year student has to go through a course that requires them to do the legal interview. They have to require first-year course. Faculty supervision.
I think Northeastern has that, the co-op program, where basically every student goes to an experience. I also know that other schools are in places or are in financial situations where it's not possible to have every student do it, and it's, in fact, clinical programs are treated as kind of an honors experience, and you have to compete for it, and so, you know, then it raises the question, well, if not every student is getting this experience, and you might be able to expect that they won't get it in any kind of formal mentoring, because I think that's the wonderful thing about clinical programs, is all of you are there as mentors, and you're watching out for the students as much as you're watching out for the clients, whereas in practice, that may not be the case. And if, should that be part of every student's experience, right? And if it can't be for logistical or financial reasons, then, you know, Debbie's point taken about the superiority of actual practice, I think there's definitely a lot to be gained from something like a simulation, where at least you get some exposure to the skill. And in fact, some ways, a simulation is a great way to lead into practice, right? Because you can control what people are going to experience. So you can't guarantee, Phil about this before, you know, that you can't guarantee who's going to show up any particular semester in terms of the cases that you're going to see. Are they going to present these particular issues? Are they going to present an ethical issue? And, you know, this particular substance issue, maybe not. So a simulation can be a way of guaranteeing you're going to get this, this, and this. It's going to lose a little bit of verisimilitude, but you also kind of pick up some pedagogical advantage as well. And if it could be done more cost-effectively and in places of the country where it might be hard to run a clinical program, you know, there are certain advantages there too. And technology does make running some of these simulations a lot cheaper when you can kind of automate a lot of it. Somebody had asked about Second Life. I just, you know, just throw this out there very quickly. I mean, I see Second Life as very similar to all these other technologies. It's a tool. And it's really a question of what do you want the tool to accomplish more than, you know, well, what, you know, what is this thing and what can we do, you know, what can we do about it? It's, I'm sure that there's a lot of great ideas out there about how to use Second Life in educational settings that I haven't encountered or thought of. One wish that I have is to be able to set up some kind of simulation where, I was thinking about property in particular, because Second Life is very land, you know, three-dimensional oriented. It's about space. And so when you think about what maps onto that, you know, environmental law, property law, those kinds of things. And so I was thinking one way you could have people experience property law rather than just simply learning about it doctrinally is to just give everybody a little tiny plot of land and then give them some set of rules that can, you know, lead them to automatically start doing things to interfere with each other's enjoyment of the land. Where the incentive is there to just put up smokestacks, and you're trying to put together a nice little park here, and the person next to you has put up a smokestack. I'm kind of dumbing it down here, but I think you can put together some very interesting ways for people to experience the meaning of the law, more than just simply, well, let's just, you know, open it up and look at the law of public nuisance. You know, there's a way to kind of have people experience that. Pedagogically, is there a lot of value to that? You know, I think we have to learn that and by trying it out. But that would be one potential use and through that being able to raise all the substantive issues that would naturally arise over the course of playing out that simulation. So that's one possible use of one potential technology. And when you kind of go through the whole litany of all the different technologies that are out there, you can imagine that for each case. But I guess the starting point is, what is it that we're trying to accomplish? I think that a few people raised the question of the wikis and kind of public education. I think as somebody who's tried to put together a website for the public, it's Mass Legal Help, for those, I'm sure all of you have seen it. It is a desperately needed thing to have people be able to put information out there for clients. In particular, the most overlooked segment is probably the kind of working class, middle class segment. Can't afford a lawyer, you're not poor enough for legal aid. Share similar issues as poor folks, so you know you can publish information that's good for everyone. But I think it's the learning experience for the student would be set very similar to what I was describing for meta lawyering, which is that you're thinking about not just a specific person, but you're also kind of backing it up to saying, well, what kind of information would be helpful for a group of people? How do I understand this problem? And in a similar way as you would learn in interviewing and counseling, how do I word it in a way that somebody can use it? Or forget about wording it. Maybe wording it is the wrong thing. Maybe reading about what we realize, I think, in a lot of our cases when we put out information for clients, is that, sure, they know cognitively, maybe by reading this, what to do about a particular situation, but they don't think they can do it. Or they don't even know physically what it feels like to walk into a courthouse. How should they dress? I mean, all these things that you may not have, I mean, I'm sure you guys all think about, but like a student wouldn't think about, how do you put that in a format that a client would understand? Is it through the format that we would understand as lawyers, which is dense text? Probably not. So what can we do to convey that information more effectively? I think that's more than just an exercise in communications strategy. I think there's something in there about understanding and having empathy with clients, understanding how a client would think at a level that would serve folks well regardless of what practice they go into. So I think that's a wonderful use of the technology, but I would step back from the technology itself and say, and look at it culturally too, about is the text the best way to do it? Can you create a video, a game, some kind of, whatever it is that's going to lead people to actually make use of that information, and rather than just read it. What we found is people just kind of get intimidated even by looking at a page of text, or they start reading about going into the courthouse and immediately get freaked out and stop because they can't imagine the idea of going into a courthouse. So there's a lot of possibility there, and I think with bandwidth becoming cheaper and cheaper, with things, you can just post these things to YouTube. I mean, why create your own site? Post things about what you should do when you go into court onto YouTube, and just make use of the fact that someone else is going to pay for your bandwidth. So that's just a thought there.
The Derek Box Center for Teaching and Learning has videos on its website. I don't know how many of you are familiar with them, but there are some very effective videos that they have people who are particularly effective in a dimension of teaching who are working with faculty on that dimension, and it's really helpful to see videos and see the faculty in practice as they're working on that. And I'm not familiar with the law school website. I don't know if there's anything comparable in terms of clinical skills and the use of videos. On the Derek Box Center, there are some that are open free to the public, and then if you want to go further, you can pay some fee for using the more extensive set.
I think I asked this question a while ago to at least the Harvard clinical professors, which is along those lines. Is there kind of a resource center for clinical professors? Because I was thinking about this from the perspective of somebody who had just created that video I just described and a whole bunch of other videos about showing best and worst practices with interviewing and counseling and all of that, and realizing, well, and people, clinical people started calling us and saying, well, can we get access to that? And I look at the negotiations program. They have a whole website where you can buy their simulations and all that. And my question, if there's some thing that we can do together, my question is there a way to create a repository of resources? I spoke with a professor at BEC who teaches ethics, and he uses clips from, I forget which TV show it is, but there's, you can take your pick of any of these legal TV shows and kind of snips out the bits of it that have to do with ethics and shows that. Putting aside copyright issues for a moment, can we find a way to, you can always, if you had enough people getting together, you could just shoot your own. It may not quite have the same dramatic value, but, is there some possibility for that? Is there any interest, desire for that? Because I'm thinking that's one very concrete thing that the technology now allows us to do, which is create and share a knowledge base with each other of very useful materials that you could, like a video that you would use to illustrate ethical issues, or a simulation for how to do a particular skill.
I think the answer is yes.
Yeah.
And is that the kind of, I don't know enough about this world, is that the kind of thing that the ALS clinical section would find interesting? That's something that Cali would take on? Just the kind of thing that I'm...
There's a chat room of clinical instructors, and there frequently are postings there asking for any simulations people have or ideas for these types of things. So there's clearly a demand for it, both here just at the law school, but beyond the law school as well.
Yeah.
the same requests cycle around every year or two, so it'd be a lot more efficient than the one. Yeah.
Right, right. So that what would it take to make that happen?
Money.
Yeah.
Time.
Same thing, right? But yeah.
I think Callie might be
The Harvard University does offer content grants and innovation grants that perhaps could be used to support an effort like this.
Right.
You've done some work in the past with Dan Shapiro from the negotiation program on piecing together a bunch of clips that he's had that he uses in his teaching as well. So we've actually done this before, but it hasn't kind of gone out into a shared medium.
Right. I mean, in the language of Berkman, if we could create a commons, where we all are sharing this information with each other. And one of the exciting things about computer-based simulations is that suddenly you can share them in a way that's different than when you just write it up and set it out there, that you can actually just run the thing, is a new possibility that's just beginning to open itself up. So if this is something of interest, then let's keep talking about that and make that one of the takeaways from this session. I'm trying to wrap this up with a quarter to two, which is about 15 minutes later than we usually run. But I'd be excited to just keep talking with everyone after we officially end this, and or for all of you to talk with each other, because I think that's also very exciting. So thank you all for your time.
Thank you.